Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. But of course, as you've come to expect, because we're now doing everything remote and we're doing it by Zoom, we actually tape on Monday afternoon, but you will hear it tomorrow. We will begin our show as we begin our show every single day between now and November of 2020. It is the words of Colonel Vindman, those powerful emotional words that he gave to the impeachment hearing in November of 2019. He had courage. His only mistake was he did the right thing. And the words that keep ringing in my ears is his words to his papa. It'll be okay, Dad. And as we've come to understand, it was not only not okay for him, for his brother, but it's not okay for us. The words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, what is my absolute favorite site in the world? Well, close to it, theconversation.com. And I have been like singing its praises every time I go on a radio show in Tampa or a radio show somewhere. I say, have you checked this out? And the reason I love theconversation.com is in a lot of ways, it is doing what I have been scolding professors for a long time. Because they have so much knowledge and they write these huge papers because, you know, publish or perish or whatever that term is. But what they don't do is actually always communicate with the public in a way that's useful. So they don't do magazine articles. They don't always write in op-eds. And yet their knowledge is so important and they get called by reporters, but the reporters just grab a little sort of slice of them and they're not able to take the time to mine them for all the knowledge they have. Well, theconversation.com has figured that out. And it has brought PhDs and professors from all over the world, actually. And now I go to theconversation.com because I get to go to the source. And as many of you know, when it comes to the issue of food and farming, it just rings lots of bells with me. And the reason it does is because my youngest daughter has been, and on occasion still is, an organic farmer. She recently was working for a small food co-op, but obviously given the nature of what's happening, everybody is sheltering in place. And if she's not working, what does that say about a lot of other people that may not be working? Last week, we interviewed a fabulous professor from Purdue, and her name was Tamara Benjamin, and she was talking about local farming and how important local farming is going to be, because as we're going to see some of the supply chains being challenged, you know, are we going to get our strawberries from California? Are we going to get, you know, whatever it is we need from places all over the world, let alone all over the United States, there may be some challenges. And we agreed, so we talked a lot about how to support local farms. Well, now here's the bookend to Tamara Benjamin. Joining us is Professor Michael Haddock. He is an associate professor of sociology at Drake University. He wrote for my favorite site, theconversation.com. And as soon as you hear that title, you'll know why I had to call him. How coronavirus threatens the seasonal farm workers at the heart of the American food supply. Let me welcome to the program, Professor Haddock. Thank you so much for joining us. And I do have to ask, so when did a professor of sociology suddenly become like hot about organic farming and farm workers? What was the connection? Is it your history and your background, or was it just something that you sort of chose to pursue?
Well, thanks so much, Arnie. I'm really happy to be here. That's a great question. I didn't grow up in a farming family, actually. So I came to organic farming as a consumer. When I was growing up, my mother was a frequent shopper at co-ops like the one where your daughter works. And so I had the experience of going to those small stores, seeing the organic food, but also seeing some of the conversation and some of the discourse about the problems in the food system and about changes that people wanted to see in the food system, both how food was grown and produced, not using pesticides or not using synthetic pesticides, and then also moving in the direction of more small farms as well and local food systems. So I was really interested in learning more about that. I went to graduate school and I did my dissertation in California, where organic farming is a big thing and there's a long history of organic farming and agriculture. And I was really interested in understanding what it meant to be part of a movement that was also part of an industry, building a market and building an industry around organic foods and farming.
Well, I'm an old lady. I'm 66. And I went to school at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. And one of my roommate's fathers was the vice president of Cargill. Oh, so I got to see agribusiness on a very intimate scale. And it's so funny because in a lot of ways, it was a good education for me to understand the agribusiness community and what that meant and what it meant in places like Iowa and Minnesota. And as it turns out, Cargill, I think, is probably the largest privately held corporation in the world, which is why nobody really knows how it's so insidious and is everywhere. But your piece really is the bookend to Tamara, because she was really concerned about what was going to happen to the food supply because of the coronavirus. But the numbers in your article at theconversation.com blew my mind. I kind of knew it, but the numbers I'm talking about are the numbers of seasonal workers that are needed in this economy, and then the number of sort of seasonal visas that are issued by the United States, and the disconnect between need and the number is pathetic. It's pathetic. And it sort of speaks about the fact that we've been living in la la land. We know that there's a problem. We choose to ignore it. And now with the coronavirus, we are putting the whole system at risk. So walk us through what you describe in your piece, because I want people to sort of understand and take notes, because if nothing else, it's going to make us realize that as we move forward, the reason why we have to deal with immigration policy, this is just one more example of why it is crucial and we are decades too late.
Absolutely. The numbers of seasonal farm workers in the United States range from 1 million to about 3 million. It's a population that's very difficult to count just because people are extremely poor, are moving around, are often living in tight quarters with many other people, often facing language barriers, and often living in fear as well if they're undocumented. So all of those things make it challenging to get an exact number of seasonal farm workers that are working in the U.S. But it is a big number, playing an essential role in the food system. Now, that visa, the H-2A visa system, allows only about 243,000 workers in 2018 were under that H-2A visa. The process of getting that visa, farmers would apply for workers under that visa. It's a fairly long and complicated process. So often it's easier for farmers to work with labor contractors or to hire workers that are not covered by that visa. Often those workers are in the country without documentation and are turning to farm work as a way to make a living for their family and for themselves.
So, and most of those farm workers, as you point out in your article, have come from Mexico. And what you also said, and again, because we don't know what the number is. I mean, the number could be 1 to 3 million. That's kind of a range, you know what I mean? And a lot of those people aren't just coming across the border for the purposes of doing whatever the picking is. They're probably here. They're probably part of the 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants that are living here right now. The problem is that they are undocumented. They don't have access to these visas. And because of the coronavirus, they are now even at greater risk than they were before when they already knew that they were a vulnerable population.
The H-2A visa is only available to people coming into the United States from another country. So a worker would have to secure that visa in Mexico or another country, come to the United States. They can only stay for 10 months. Then they have to return to the country of origin. So it's a fairly long process. For workers in the United States, there really is no alternative but to seek work as undocumented workers. And in that situation, they are so vulnerable to exploitation from labor contractors or from farmers themselves, and also vulnerable to the coronavirus because of the condition in which they work. Farm work takes place at a very, very rapid pace. There isn't time for people to take breaks to wash their hands. People interact with one another in the process of harvesting. It's often a multi-step process where one person does one thing and then passes the product off to another person who sorts it or grades it. So there's a lot of social interaction, more than you would think, that's involved in harvesting crops. And we all know that social interaction is the way that this virus spreads. Social isolation really isn't possible for farm workers.
What I'm concerned about is that you have to apply in Mexico in order to come into the United States for 10 months or wherever the country is of origin. We've shut down borders. We know that a lot of the embassies are either not operating or preoccupied. So what does it mean about the legal visas and how are we going to process them? What does it mean for when they come and why would they come, knowing that they're coming into a place where it isn't just about picking a crop, it's about possibly getting ill. So I think you've got a problem with that number. And then of course, that doesn't include the 1 to 2 million, if not more than that, who are currently in the United States undocumented doing the picking, and they are vulnerable and even more vulnerable to the illness, as you point out, not just because of how they live, but because they're working in places where there are pesticides, where they haven't had real access to healthcare, where they probably have pre-existing conditions. So not only is the setting ripe for them to get COVID-19, but the setting is also ripe, given who they are, to become very ill.
Yeah, those are exactly the things that are concerning to farmers and really should be concerning to all of us as people who rely on the food system every day, even if we don't understand or haven't thought very much about where that food comes from. On one hand, yes, embassies are closed, consulates are closed in other countries, U.S. consulates. The H-2A visa process, because farm workers are designated as essential critical infrastructure workers, that visa program is still open, but we have to wonder who is going to be processing those visas.
Exactly.
And what's this? How smoothly will this process run with the embassies and consulates closed? So that's one concern. And another concern is, will people apply for these visas in the same number, given the risks now that exist in this new reality that we're living in, with the pandemic and with the dangers of farm work? People may find other opportunities to support themselves more closely to home. So it's a real concern for farmers. Will there be enough workers to harvest the crops that are necessary for the food supply?
But you just made a really interesting comment. You said that these were essential visas. They're essential workers. But if we know that they're only maybe one fifth of what we actually need, those essential workers, whether they come or not, doesn't describe the 2 or 3 million that we're actually using right now, of which a lot of them are undocumented. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to figure out is, we talk about all the frontline people that we have to care about. We have to care about the doctors and the nurses and the people that work at the grocery stores and the firefighters. And, well, guess what? This group belongs in that list too, because you still need to eat, okay? And the only thing you're really allowed to go to is a pharmacy and a grocery store. So this is going to put a huge challenge on people's sense of security. I mean, they really are. They're already afraid. They don't know whether they're going to get the money to pay the bills. But what they're also afraid about is that if eventually down the road, there won't be the requisite amount of food coming through because these people are not able to pick the food. It's going to rot, in the fields. And the farmers who've already spent the money to buy a lot of the seeds and the fertilizers, they're screwed twice. They've made the investment and now they can't access that investment. Is there anyone in Washington that gets it, that says, maybe we have to blink? Maybe we have to sort of tell ICE or look at all these undocumented folks and say, for the purposes of the COVID-19 pandemic, you're okay. We're not going to deport you. And maybe even more important than that, we're going to protect you.
Yeah, those are fantastic questions. Farm workers really are essential. Agriculture is an essential infrastructure, but the protections that farm workers receive really don't measure up to the role that they play for all of us. Historically, it's been that way for a long time. Farm workers have been exempted from some of the laws, the federal laws, that protect workers in other sectors of our economy. They don't often qualify for overtime. In some cases, they don't even qualify to have a protected minimum wage at the federal level. Now, some states are actually working to try to bring some additional protections to farm workers in this new environment. But of course, states don't control immigration enforcement. And so their efforts in that area really are limited. But they can and they do try to provide some additional sanitary and maybe even healthcare facilities in the
future. And you wanted to say something?
Yeah, just even if ICE could be persuaded, which I don't know if it can, to give some kind of exception to all of the millions of undocumented workers in this country already who will be needed to harvest our crops, how can ICE be trusted to actually keep its promise? In other words, if I am an undocumented person in the United States now, I am scared to death that ICE is just going to come in and batter my door down or arrest me falsely pretending I'm swerving or something, or come into the courtroom when I go against my landlord to get the water turned on.
Let me just make a
ICE
point here.
ICE is going to arrest you. And
how
do you trust them to keep
Ken,
their promise?
Ken, it's not going to be ICE's promise. It's got to be the federal regulation. There has to be some kind of rulemaking, executive order. That's not about ICE. Am I right about this, Michael? I mean, I would think that it would have, and the reason I say this, I sent this to Michael. So as I was thinking about what's going to happen with these workers, we have seen exceptions in other situations where there has been, it wasn't a pandemic, but it was a hurricane. It was called Hurricane Katrina. So what you don't know, Michael, is that I went down to New Orleans to do cleanup. And when I went down to New Orleans to do cleanup, two things shocked me. One, I saw virtually no African-American. Everybody was speaking Spanish. Everybody, every guy on the roof, every guy that was pulling stuff out of the houses that had rotted. I'm like, whoa, this is really amazing. And then I understood what was going on. And they were selling t-shirts in downtown New Orleans. And the t-shirts had the following letters on it. FEMA. Now you think it stood for FEMA. No. It stood for Find Every Mexican Available. And the reason I am telling you this is that I also then remembered, how was this possible? These were clearly people who are, for the most part, most of them not documented, were coming in to work in horrific conditions. And there was no ICE, and there was no one coming over, there was no raids going on. And then I found this, and I remembered this because I did a little work after I got home from New Orleans. So great was the demand for workers that the Bush administration temporarily suspended immigration regulations that required employers to verify the immigration status of people who worked for them. In doing so, it allowed federal contractors to hire undocumented workers to help meet the demand. Ooh, when we needed them, we blinked. So, Michael, as you're looking at this issue, and this issue is cataclysmic potentially, it's a health issue, it's a food issue, it's a health and safety issue for the people that are working in the fields, it's a health and safety issue for those of us that are going to need that food. Do you see anyone in the U.S. Senate, in the House, and maybe even in Trump's administration that understand, just like George Bush blinked because they needed to rebuild after Katrina, and these are the only people who they knew would come back and do it, given the kind of conditions they were working in, which even by that alone should describe how disgusting it is. But this is crucial. This isn't a back burner issue. This is an issue that must be addressed now.
Arnie, I have not seen that at this time, and I don't know whether those conversations are going on, but I'll tell you that my concern still is that even if those immigration enforcement actions were dialed back, the labor abuses could well still continue and maybe even would be more likely to occur in an environment where people are so stressed and there is this pressure on the food system to generate a harvest, generate crops for people. Now, there are organizations that are working very hard to bring protections to farm workers during this critical time. And I would hope that those organizations are receiving widespread support, because again, this is a matter that affects not only farm workers, but also eaters. Here's an example of one of those. About a week ago, Greg Asped, who is one of the founders of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, that's a farm worker rights organization based in Florida, especially among people who work in the tomato fields, really horrendous conditions in the tomato fields.
I know.
He published an editorial in the New York Times where he called on the governor of Florida to provide funding for field hospitals in the fields to treat workers, and also sanitary facilities in the field so workers could protect themselves. And those are the types of things where I think, you know, that could be more of the conversation now as we come to realize how dependent we are on workers and on the efforts and the labor that they provide. We can start to think more carefully about how our health and well-being in terms of our nutrition really are linked to the conditions and to the labor of other people.
I have to grab that article. I'm going to make sure I post it alongside this interview. But as I'm thinking about this, the farmers, maybe they've treated them badly. Maybe they haven't provided them with adequate sanitary conditions. Now they're shooting themselves in the head if they continue to do this, because they thought that they didn't see them. How do I say this? They didn't see the potential for the pandemic to wipe out their entire workforce. So to a large extent, coronavirus is an opportunity for farmers to value these people and value their health, value their safety, value their sanitary conditions, value whether they have those field hospitals. They need this because it could wipe out everyone that's picking. And there isn't going to be a second round to come in. So a lot of ways, it's kind of a come to Jesus moment for those farmers, as much as it is to protect those people, which they should have been protecting before, but now more than ever, they have to, because they're not just going to see a couple of them drop. They could see hundreds get ill, given the sort of tenuous nature of their health conditions anyway, going in to pick those crops.
It really is. And it's an opportunity as well for us as consumers, right, to become more aware and to support those organizations that are working to improve the condition of farm workers. Not only thinking about what's the best deal that we could have and what's the cheapest product that we could buy, right, but also thinking about what did it mean to somebody who worked hard to bring this food to our grocery stores or bring this food to our restaurants, and how can we support them in the work that they do and improve the conditions under which they work. Because it does take something like a pandemic sometimes for us to realize that the hardships of other people working in the food system can eventually affect us as consumers.
Yeah, I hear you about the farmers appreciating their undocumented workers, but I think it's not as big a problem for the farmers as it is for the federal government, the ICE people. My brother-in-law was a dairy farmer in northern New Hampshire. He had Mexican people taking care of his animals and picking the corn and everything like that. All the time, constantly. And they were almost like members of his family. You know, he cared about them. But I'll tell you, the people in my community in New Hampshire, and I've been to Matamoros, Mexico, the other side of the border, Homestead, Florida, people are really not trusting of ICE. No matter what the rules say, Arnie, you're right. Obviously, it has to be in the rules and regulations. But this government has acted so illegally so many times, and people get deported. I mean, you wind up in the woods in Guatemala, you don't care if it was legal or not.
So let me just say,
you're stuck.
Let me just say something. So Professor Haddock, as I'm listening to Ken, I see two groups standing up for these workers. People who are no longer working in the restaurant business, who are talking about how important they are, they're getting a lot of FaceTime. They're getting a lot of time. They should talk about the fact the food chain. This is a great opportunity for these very famous restaurant owners to talk about, I don't just care about the people that work in my restaurant. I care about the people that pick the lettuce. I care, because even if my restaurant doesn't need lettuce, you do. And I see them being able to carry the banner. I see grocery workers and grocery store owners carrying the banner and saying, we are in this together. And it may not be that the administration gets it, but if all of a sudden you hear the drumbeat from people that are actually getting a lot of FaceTime because we're suddenly realizing we have to value them, they can connect the dots back to the people that are the invisible people. And for the most part, these pickers are invisible until we suddenly realize without them, what do we eat? What do we eat?
Absolutely. Food is something that really has that potential to connect all of us, farm workers, grocery store workers, consumers, restaurant owners, restaurant workers. But the food system sometimes divides us because people are so separated. And because there is that tension, paying somebody more means less for me. Farmers are often working on very, very low margins. And it sometimes does take something big to draw attention to that, start a conversation about that, and maybe create some change in that system and in the conditions that people are experiencing.
Dr. Haddock, keep writing about this, because this is like important, important stuff. I've got to grab that article from the New York Times because I want people to read it. The idea of the field hospitals is important. But what I want people to do is I want people in New York City and Boston not only to cheer the firefighters, not only to cheer the grocery workers, but to understand they have to cheer these folks as well. They may not see them, but they so need them. They so need them. Thank you so much for writing this piece of the conversation. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Arnie. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. Stick around when we come back. One of my faves, Mark Stern from Slate.com. They want to have an election today in Wisconsin, because remember, we tape on Monday, but it's doing election on Tuesday. Anyway, Mark Stern is next from Slate. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1882. That was the day trade union leader and suffragist Rose Schneiderman was born. She arrived from Poland and settled in New York City with her family as a child. Her father died soon after, and Rose entered the workforce at the age of 13. She sewed caps and organized with the United Cloth and Cap Makers. Rose became a chief organizer with the New York Women's Trade Union League and played a prominent role in the 1909 uprising of the 20,000. While touring Ohio to rally support for women's suffrage in 1912, Schneiderman said, "What the women who labor wants is the right to live, not simply exist. The right to life as the rich woman has the right to life, and the sun and music and art. You have nothing that the humblest worker has not a right to have also. The worker must have bread, but she must have roses too." She grew frustrated with the privileged middle-class women of the New York Women's Trade Union League and began organizing with the ILGWU. But she soon quit, aggravated by the leadership's indifference towards organizing women workers. Schneiderman devoted her energies to women's suffrage. She would soon return to the Women's Trade Union League. By 1926, she served as its national president and became close friends with Eleanor Roosevelt. President Franklin Roosevelt appointed her to the National Advisory Board, where she wrote NRA codes for industries with women workers. Labor historian Annalise Orlek noted, "Schneiderman attacked sexual segregation in the workplace, tried to unionize women, called for state regulations of working conditions. She argued for comparable worth laws, government-funded childcare, and maternity insurance. Those ideas and dreams are the legacy of Rose Schneiderman." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
What if every single soul with an opinion got to have their say? If on every point of note we simply took a vote,
we'd build a new tomorrow here today.
So, the butcher gets a vote?
Yep.
The baker gets a vote?
Yep. And everyone who couldn't vote before.
Except, of course, the women.
And we won't let him or him in.
We mean everybody else.
Except the poor.
Progressive for the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Then we vote on every pressing public question. Either
yay!
Or
nay!
Nice.
Everybody gets to choose.
Except the you-know-who.
As we build a new tomorrow here today. If you'd like to make a statement or suggestion, simply stand.
Oh.
And
him?
Every person counts the same.
Except, of course,
the lame.
And the lepers.
And the gingers.
And the witches.
And the heathens.
And the bastards.
And the gypsies.
And the commies.
And the hippies.
As we build a new tomorrow.
A fair and square tomorrow.
A more aware tomorrow than today. So we all march together towards the future.
Well, not all per se. Just the ones who look like me.
It's called democracy.
The landed,
and the wealthy,
and the pious,
and the healthy,
and the straight ones,
and the pale ones,
and we only mean the male ones.
If you're all of the above, then you're okay.
As we build a new tomorrow here today.
Welcome Welcome back to Part 2 of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As many of you know, we Zoom this, so that means we tape on Monday for you to hear on Tuesday when we air the show. But we had to join one of our favorite reporters. Mark Joseph Stern writes for Slate.com. He writes about law and the courts. And there was just like a whole potpourri of articles that I wanted to interview him about. But the one that I think I have to start with is the one that he wrote on April 2nd. Now, we're taping this on April 6th, but this is really important because that piece on April 2nd was just the beginning of the conversation we're going to have now because things were wild on Monday. The article was entitled, "Wisconsin Republicans Want to Make It Harder to Vote During the Coronavirus Outbreak." Next week, which is this week, voters will decide a crucial state Supreme Court seat. The pandemic could swing the outcome. Now, as we join Mark Joseph Stern, there were a whole series and flurry of activity that was happening this morning. My understanding is, Mark, that the Wisconsin legislature met and they adjourned practically as soon as they met, which was basically, screw you to the Democratic governor. We're going to hold this election. We're not going to do anything. And then I saw an article from Politico, and you can share with our audience because you just filed a new piece for Slate.com. So what happened this morning? What happened with the governor? And where are we vis-a-vis the election, which will be held Tuesday, which is actually the day this show airs?
Right. So this is all fast moving and a lot will have changed by the time the show airs. But as we speak on Monday afternoon, Monday, April 6th, what's happened is the governor, Tony Evers, who is a Democrat, has canceled the election. He has issued an executive order that postpones in-person voting on April 7th using his broad powers as governor, as chief executive, to protect the health and well-being of citizens of Wisconsin. So he called the legislature into a special session, asked them to postpone the election. The legislature refused. Republicans think that postponing the election would hurt their odds. So he just said, I'm going to do it myself. And that is going to be litigated up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court over the next few hours. By the time this airs, people will know how it turned out. But Republicans in the legislature are rushing as we speak today to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to say, reinstate the election, make it go forward.
So I'm looking at, I haven't seen your article since you just filed it. So I've got the other article from Politico.com. I apologize.
No problem.
But what I have here is Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers issued a last minute order halting in-person voting on Tuesday amid the coronavirus concerns, calling for the suspending of the statewide and local elections until June 9th. So he says, we'll have an election, but let's give us some time. And then what he says is the virus directs us as to what our decision-making is, not human beings. And clearly I am following the science, oh, Republicans hate science. Anyway, that's my aside. As I always have, ever so Politico. Ever said he heard from constituents relaying fear for their safety, their kids' safety, as he tracked updates about the number of deaths and rates of infections in Wisconsin. Given that, I felt that the governor is the one who has to step up and stand for those people that aren't having their voices heard. So I just got to ask you a question, Mark. Do Republicans not have children? Republicans don't have grandparents? What is it? And do Republicans think that they're going to be hermetically sealed and only Republicans are going to vote? So they're going to sweep this election and get everything they want? Because I talked to a couple of my very liberal friends. They said they would hermetically seal themselves, put themselves into almost like a human condom and go in and vote because they are so angry at the GOP. They're so angry at Donald Trump that the motivation for them to vote is great. At the same time, they understand this is a life and death situation. And I don't understand how the GOP thinks that they won't have any blowback from people when they realize that they're willing to risk the electorate because of what? Of what?
So the Republicans in Wisconsin seem to have done a kind of cost-benefit analysis. So they appear to have recognized, I mean, they must know on some level, that holding the election on Tuesday will kill people, right? But they seem to think it will kill more Democrats than Republicans. And they seem to think that because the infections are obviously located largely in urban areas. That is where more people are. And that is where more people are spreading the virus. And so there are places like Milwaukee that have gone from hundreds of polling places down to a handful. And those areas are disproportionately Black. And They are disproportionately young and they are disproportionately Democratic. And so Republicans seem to think that the people who go out and risk their lives to vote are going to be Black Democrats, and that, you know, Republicans don't care about them. In fact, they probably are happier if they can't vote because they're dead. The other element of this is that there's a lot of absentee voting going on. There's a big fight in federal court over absentee voting and the deadline and all of that. But suffice it to say that Republicans seem to think that their constituents will have already voted absentee, that they've got these races in the bag. They don't want to extend this at all. They don't want to delay the election. They just want to tally up the votes as they stand today because they think they'll have won.
Boy, we're on the same page. So just let me tell you about Saturday afternoon. Here's what I posted on Facebook. COVID while Black. As of Friday, African Americans made up one half of Milwaukee County's 945 cases. 81% of the deaths were African Americans. The county has only 26% Black. So exactly your point is exactly what they're doing. They saw these numbers and they said, gold, we can win. I mean, it's just the level of immorality is shocking. Right. So now they're going to rush to the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. So tell me a little bit about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because one of the things that you write about is that there's an important election about a Supreme Court justice that is also very important. So tell me about what the complexion of the court is today. Will they favor killing people because the GOP has done their cost-benefit analysis, or will they come to a higher angel and recognize that, you know, while they may be Republicans and they may be conservative, death really shouldn't be part of their agenda?
Right. So the Wisconsin Supreme Court is really the crown jewel of the Kochs effort to remake Wisconsin under Scott Walker. So one thing that the Kochs realized when they poured millions and millions of dollars into essentially buying Wisconsin, right, buying the legislature, buying the governorship, is that it was no good if the state Supreme Court would still strike down power grabs. So they also purchased the state Supreme Court quite effectively. They poured millions and millions of dollars into a number of elections that put several hardline conservatives on the court. There's currently a 5-2 conservative majority. And one of those members of the conservative majority is up for re-election in this Wisconsin election, whenever it happens. His name is Daniel Kelly, and he is facing a liberal challenger. He's probably best known for saying that affirmative action and slavery spring from the same taproot. And this is a quote, morally and as a matter of law, they are the same. He is white, in case you're wondering.
I picked the short straw. I was going to say something else. No. Of course he's white. Okay.
So Republicans really want this guy to win, because if he loses, then Republicans only have a 4-3 majority and Democrats can flip that court in the next election. So the big move here is to try to keep Daniel Kelly on the Wisconsin Supreme Court by basically allowing the pandemic to suppress votes. And a question that now arises is whether Kelly will vote on this issue, because it directly affects him.
Oh, he is
on the state Supreme Court that is about to decide whether an election will still be held.
There's no indication
that he's going to recuse. Now, perhaps he'll surprise me and he will recuse. That's always a possibility. You know, I don't want to be the most cynical person in the world, but, you know, it is a little odd that it's now going to be going to his court to decide, you know, just another reason why electing judges is not really the best idea in the world.
Well,
the Republicans are going to win on the Supreme Court, even if Kelly recuses, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I think, you know, even if Kelly recuses, it becomes a 4-2 split instead of a 5-2 split. So,
yeah, I mean, think Scalia... I understand that. But a few years ago, Scalia refused to recuse, or somebody refused to accuse themselves when it was a 5-4
problem. Oh, yeah. I mean, Scalia did that all the time.
There's no reason why Kelly shouldn't recuse.
This is life and death. I mean, that's the thing that I just quite don't understand. So here's my question. So rearrange the chairs for me. So the legislature meets, they met, they said goodbye, forget about it, we're not going to change the date. Mm-hmm. The governor then steps in and says, this is a health and safety issue. I'm canceling the election until June. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to rush it to the Supreme Court.
The state Supreme Court.
Is there any other move left after this? Or is the state Supreme Court the seal of the prophet? Are we done with them? Or is there a higher authority that we can go to? Because we are seriously talking about life and death. And as you mentioned, for example, in Milwaukee, that we already know that a lot of people would have to show up to vote. You just mentioned that they've shrunk the number of voting places because the GOP loves to suppress votes. So what you've done is you've created these situations that basically violate everything that Donald Trump said. Can I bring in my little card from Donald Trump? You have to be 6 feet apart. You should be socially isolated. You shouldn't come out. And I'm going to say, my president tells me this. Yeah. So aren't I actually violating what my president said because I got the postcard from Donald Trump?
Right. I'm sorry. Can I just read, I was speaking to a member of the Wisconsin Election Commission right before I got on this call, Ann Jacob. Good. She is one of the Democratic members of the commission.
Okay.
She said something really amazing that stuck with me. She said, people shouldn't have to choose between their safety and their right to vote. John Lewis is a hero because he risked his life to vote, but that is not the standard to which the ordinary citizen should be held to exercise the franchise.
That's Good point. Oh my God. So at this point, we don't know, even though the show will air on Tuesday, I just want people to understand the chaos going into this election. But I also want people to understand the kinds of horrific choices people are being asked to make.
Right.
And that's what, now I have to ask one more question before we go on to judges. And that is, tell me a little bit about, can anyone do an absentee ballot?
Yeah, so this ties into your previous question about where the highest authority lies. So while all of this is going on, there's actually a separate issue here about absentee ballots. So basically, Wisconsin does allow absentee balloting. It allows mail-in balloting. You don't have to have an excuse. But the state is experiencing such a massive surge in requests for absentee ballots. I mean, it is a million more requests than they were at this time last year, more than that at this stage, that election officials literally can't process them in time. So there's a state law that says that any ballot received after the election dates, after April 7th, it can't be counted. And you have election officials right now who are in court testifying, we cannot turn around these requests for absentee ballots quickly enough to ensure that voters can return them by that date. So a federal court has extended that date by a week. The U.S. Supreme Court was about to decide whether to uphold that or not when the governor canceled the election. So even if the Wisconsin State Supreme Court allows the election to move forward and rejects the governor's cancellation, there's still this whole other bucket of litigation about which absentee ballots count and which don't, and that could affect thousands of people's rights to franchise.
What's the federal question for the U.S. Supreme Court to even consider that appeal?
There's no federal question about the date of the election, but there's a federal question about the right to vote and the right to have one's vote counted and not arbitrarily thrown away.
Yeah,
and
but so, it goes the other way, right? The governor's order, or the order that extends the absentee ballots by a week, protects people's right to vote. So the state saying you should reverse that and send it back to April 7th, that is not anti-voting, that's pro-voting.
Right, yeah. It's the whole thing is a total muddle. And I think the Supreme Court is probably glad that it doesn't have to issue anything right now because all of this is going on with the governor and the legislature. But at some point, there's got to be an adult in the room who sorts all of this out for good.
Yeah. Oh my God. Maybe they could send Dr. Fauci in. maybe Dr. Fauci should say, listen, I'm going to tell you why you can't hold this election. And I'm not only am I the scientist, but I'm the doctor in the room. And maybe that's the only adult that actually happens. Thank you for sharing this chaos with me. Now I'm even more depressed. Well, let's go to the original reason why I reached out to you, which is another article that you wrote. And the article was about, no surprise, Trump elevates unqualified judge as, this is my favorite part, reward for defending Kavanaugh. So can you talk to me about this unqualified judge, one of many that have been approved by Mitch McConnell and the U.S. Senate, but this one takes the cake. This is unbelievable.
This guy literally only has his job because he's already a judge, right? He's already a district court judge. He's 37. He has no qualifications to be a district court judge. He's already on the federal bench as a reward for defending Kavanaugh. He did 162 media hits in defense of Brett Kavanaugh in between Kavanaugh's nomination, actually starting shortly before his nomination and going all the way through to his confirmation, including during the Christine Blasey Ford episode when he said that she was just mistaken and, you know, had the wrong guy and didn't understand what he was talking about. And he actually said that some of the Democratic senators on the Judicial Committee should be investigated instead of Brett Kavanaugh. So this guy is just like a rank partisan. Right. And Mitch McConnell turns around and rewards him for all of his Fox News hits by giving him a judgeship on the federal district court in Kentucky. Totally unqualified. ABA says not qualified. He's been on the court for less than 6 months. And what's happened now? Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump turn around and nominate him to the DC Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, the second most powerful and important court in the nation that basically decides whether federal laws and federal regulations are legal or not. Yeah.
So in other words, under the Trump administration, you fail upwards, is what you're telling me.
If you are a straight white man, you fail upwards. Otherwise, okay, you don't even get your foot in the door.
Right. So I want to remind, and he was rated unqualified.
Yeah.
By the Bar Association, am I right? And
yeah,
and they
right.
don't they don't do that very often. So
he was the seventh nominee of Trump's rank, not qualified.
Okay. So, but he has worked for interesting people. My understanding is he worked for Justice Kennedy and he worked for Kavanaugh. Is that true?
Yes, he clerked for Kavanaugh when Kavanaugh was on the D.C. Circuit, and then he went on and clerked for Kennedy when Kennedy was, of course, a justice on the Supreme Court. So he has this clerking experience. But then after that, as the ABA said, the American Bar Association said, it was difficult to determine how much of his time was actually spent in the practice of law. He's never served as lead counsel or co-counsel on any case, civil or criminal. He has no clear trial experience in the courtroom. He's like taken a deposition. I mean, that's pretty much the extent of his judicial, legal experience that might qualify him for a judgeship. So, you know, if simply clerking for right-wing judges qualifies you for the bench, then I guess we can accept his nomination. But I kind of thought we had higher standards than that for lifetime tenure.
Well, what I love about your article, because you always write so well, is that I just want to let people to know what kind of a, can I say this, political whore? But I will say it anyway. I said he touted Kavanaugh's record on conservative issues like the Second Amendment, executive power, EPA regulations. He predicted that Kavanaugh's confirmation would usher in an end to affirmative action, an end to successful litigation about religious displays and prayers, an end to bans on semi-automatic rifles, an end to almost all judicial decisions allowing abortion. Oh my God, he's like a conservative wet dream. I mean, it was just amazing what he did. I mean, it was like he was so over the top.
Yeah.
What he said, there was no restraint. It was all pure politics. And it was politics on steroids. I mean, there's one thing. I'm political. You know that. You're political. But we are at least, there's some limits to what we will say. This guy pulled out all the stops and made Kavanaugh like the second coming for whatever you want, he was going to deliver.
Right. And let's just note one more thing that Walker said. I think Judge Kavanaugh fits that bill. If you imagine him storming a beach, his military uniforms torn and tattered from fighting for conservative legal principles, he thinks of Kavanaugh as a general, as a warrior. I mean, what kind of freaky cosplay is that? That this, you know, this judge who's just writing opinions is like a warrior in one of those weird Trump paintings where he's like, you know, shrouded in American flags and leading the people across the Red Sea. The whole thing is so gross. It's almost fetishistic.
Well, Mark, it's actually the opposite. Isn't the rule of law supposed to be a more nonviolent way to resolve disputes than
not that. What is it?
Physical war.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I was going to say is that the worst thing I think about this guy's potential is the fact that being on the DC circuit, that's the court that gets the appeals from all of the federal agencies. And there is a serious problem with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Both are very strongly disapproving of the administrative state and don't think that the executive branch should exercise anywhere near the kind of power over our economy and our society as they do. And they're looking to, and have written articles about rolling it back. So to have this third guy on the court to be a member of this army, if you will, of warriors to roll back the administrative agencies, that is devastating.
Absolutely.
Well, you're upset about the DC court. I keep focused on he's 37. He's 37. He's 37. My children will be dead before, you know, he's off the bench. I mean, this is the other problem. I mean, I have a funny feeling that if Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell could find people in utero, they would probably appoint them to the bench. I mean, this is the younger, the better, because they really want to sort of be in perpetuity their ideology continues. So tell me a little bit about Florida. That was one story. I just want people to know, because, you know, what we've seen is we've seen a divide. Democratic governors and Republican governors that are surrounded by Democrats, i.e. the governor of Maryland, the governor of Massachusetts, you know, governors that are sort of informed by a more balanced and reasonable approach, Republicans, they've shut down their states. They've approached COVID-19 in a rational and reasonable way, and they understand that we are dealing with a pandemic. Not so much Republicans, you know, Florida, Texas, oy vey. You wrote a piece about the Commissioner of Agriculture. So tell me, what could the Commissioner of Agriculture do that the governor did not?
Yeah, well, so you have to understand that in Florida, the Commissioner of Agriculture is arguably second in command in state government. She's independently elected. She's very important. She also runs the whole Consumer Affairs Bureau of state government. And she is the only statewide elected Democrat in office right now in Florida, Nikki Freed. So Nikki Freed has been watching as Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, basically ignores the coronavirus for as long as possible, right? During spring break in mid-March, he refused to shut down the beaches, the bars, the amusement parks. Disney World stayed open. He still hasn't shut down all the beaches. He's a total denier of a lot of facts about coronavirus. You know, he claimed that asymptomatic people couldn't spread it, something we've seen among a lot of Republican leaders, right? And so while he was doing nothing, Nikki Freed was getting her stuff together, saying, how are we going to keep the state running during a pandemic? So what happens during a pandemic? Schools close. What happens when schools close? Kids can't get lunch. So what does Nikki Freed start doing? Negotiating with the USDA, getting waivers from the federal government, setting up programs to help kids get free lunches all throughout the school year, even when schools are closed, maintaining food banks and food supplies so that low-income people could still get food, making sure that all fraud, scams, and price gouging attempts are shut down immediately. These things are spiraling out of control in a lot of states. She is setting up the entire state, preparing to keep the state fed and under control, while DeSantis is not even taking her phone calls, not even answering the phone from really the second in command in Florida during the onslaught of a pandemic. So, I mean, this is really a good dichotomy between how Republicans and Democrats have approached this crisis.
So you said she's second in command. Can he override her?
Not on issues that are squarely within her authority, namely food-related stuff, agriculture-related stuff, consumer affairs, and a lot of school-related stuff.
I want to call my friends at Harvard. I want to get her a Profiles in Courage Award. You know what I mean? I want people to know what Jay Inslee did in the state of Washington. I want people to be able to compare and contrast.
Yeah,
and the problem is we're all in a funny way. I mean, we hear Governor Cuomo, and there's value to what Governor Cuomo does. But I think people really need to see the other people who've been responding in a rational and reasonable way, and that they make a difference in whether people survive or not. And that it's not just, you know, the governor of New York, that this is happening everywhere, but there's something very frightening here, because what you're describing is you have to have a D next to your name, not an R next to your name. And what I saw, I mean, I don't know if it was your article, but it was maybe another article, that the Democratic governor of Kentucky is suddenly finding out there are a lot of people that now like him. Why? Republicans are starting to like him, because they're suddenly realizing that coming out of him is the leadership they need in a pandemic, not the quack stuff that's coming out of the Republicans who happen to, you know, represent them in Congress or in Washington. And that is actually elevating him, which may be useful going into November of 2020.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, look at Tennessee and Kentucky in terms of COVID-19 cases over the last few weeks, right? Tennessee has a Republican governor. Kentucky has a Democratic governor. Tennessee cases spiraling upwards, infections totally out of control. Kentucky cases staying much flatter. They are flattening that curve. Why? Because the Democratic governor of Kentucky put in a stay-at-home order early. He closed non-essential businesses and services early. He took it seriously. Tennessee's governor shrugged and just took all of his cues from Trump, who did nothing. And now people are going to die because of that.
This and the Florida governor is a perfect example of why it's so important to vote and to get out the vote. When Andrew Gillum was running against DeSantis in Florida, just like Stacey Abrams in Georgia with Kemp, everybody was excited these two wonderful people might win. And then when they lost in very close elections, it's sort of, okay, that's off our radar now, and let's just sort of move on to the next thing. But the consequences for real people's lives that follow these close election losses, the consequences are enormous. People die.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a life or death matter.
And what is so interesting is that we're now seeing that elections are a life and death matter in the sense of whether you could actually exercise the franchise. That's really what the fight was when we began this conversation about Wisconsin. Now we're seeing that your choice for governor, your choice for commissioner of agriculture, whatever, that too is a life and death situation. So it's not just exercising the vote to get the person that you think will represent you, but when you realize the consequences of bad choices.
Right.
Now, a bad choice that kills you, that kills you. And you've heard Donald Trump say he doesn't care about whether you can vote in November because he doesn't want you to vote in November. Virtually said that. I mean, that's what's so terrifying. And yet now I'm not sure he's just the liar in chief. I think we have to start giving him another title, even more horrific. Mark Stern, thank you so much for doing this. This show will air on Tuesday. We're talking to a reporter from Slate.com. We'll make sure that the new piece that you just put up is up, and maybe even by Tuesday morning, you'll have another piece up. it'll be round three, but people need to understand how chaotic this is.
Yeah.
This is not just bad for elections, it's bad for people's trust.
Absolutely. Terrible for people's trust.
Exactly. And yet these issues have such consequences for them. So thank you so much for joining us. And it's wonderful to be able to see Mark Joseph Stern. Thank you. Thank you, Zoom. This is
wonderful to see you too as well.
All right. Okay, ciao. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care, Mark.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming through a crack in the wall on a visionary flood of alcohol from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't to understand it all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA. To America first. the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family is broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy's coming to the USA.